Men Should Talk. My aim in these talks is to introduce and illustrate the model of the self I've been using at Men Should Talk over the past 12 years. This model involves taking into account the relationships that men have built up with their bodies, with others, with their thinking, and with their emotions. Clients achieve a more balanced state of being when they're able to understand how these relationships have formed. They then feel empowered to develop warmer and more supportive relationships with these four elements and, in turn, with other people. In the course of our busy and fractured lives, it's usually the case that we fall into certain patterns of thinking and responding that come to define us as people. We live in circuits of expectation in which our behavior is understood in certain relatively fixed ways. But when a crisis of some sort occurs, it can reveal our habitual relationship to ourselves in a fresh and sometimes disturbing light. The core of my approach involves considering the history of how we've come to develop the relationships we have to ourselves and then offer tools to change those relationships. The aim is to move away from habit and compulsion towards comfortable, balanced choice. The body. I'd like to begin by considering the relationship to the body. It's always fascinating to hear how clients explain what it is that has led them to seek therapy. For the most part, their complaint is based on anxiety and how the symptoms of anxiety have led them to behave in certain ways or to experience certain unpleasant sound effects. But what is often missing from the description of their condition is any consideration of the body. It is as if the body were merely a machine they were operating via their brains. The reasons for this response are many and complex, not the least of which is the influence of cognitive behavioral therapy, whose approach is to improve the functioning of the brain to better order our thoughts. However, whilst this approach has its merits, it pays little attention to the ways in which our bodily experience is a fundamental element in how we know ourselves and respond to our world. As the body is there before we can think about it and will be there at the end of our days, it seems foolish, even irresponsible, to disregard it. What I'd like to do here is illustrate the value of deepening our relationship to the body so that we can see it not merely as a machine, but as a potential resource which can fundamentally improve the quality of our lives. But let me begin with a typical, generalized example of how the body is sidelined or even ignored in therapy. I make a point of having to talk through his history in the first free consultation. I encourage him to describe his childhood and put particular emphasis on his early life. I try to disturb his habitual chronological narrative to open up new directions and bring to light experiences which he may have overlooked before. In the course of such explorations, it's not unusual for a man to reveal that he's experienced a great deal of bullying. The tendency, though, is to dismiss this out of hand, as if it belonged to the past of someone who was grown past this. However, his complaint of anxiety will have distinctly embodied elements. For example, his approach to authority may be a cautious and even frightened one. What resides in his body is a fear that the disapproval of authority figures will trigger a frightened anxiety about being bullied again. A series of cognitive tools will only go so far when the body is tense and breathing is shallow and rapid. Our bodies keep a constant tally of how to survive and will do all it can to protect the individual. The threat of more bullying brings on a deeply rooted response which must be attended to and not pathologized as wrong, silly, or irrational. The task then is to understand how it is that a client has developed his relationship to his body. Only after this has been brought to bodily awareness and consciousness can we progress to make the changes that will enable him to feel more at home in and with himself. My model breaks down the relationship to the body into four categories. The first of these is nurture. Ideally, the first few years of life are spent in a space where the child is the principal focus of the mother's life and in which the interactions between mother and child are warm and reciprocative. The child that develops in such easeful circumstances feels deep down that he is being nurtured. At this crucial time, he experiences an acceptance of himself that is deeply grounding and comforting. However, it is more often the case that this period of nurture is marked by the disruptions of everyday life. The instability of the family, the unpredictability of the economy, the changing political fortunes of the day all work to create an environment in which nurture can be replaced by management. In place of a warm and gentle introduction to life, the child can become something that has to be managed into the correct spaces and places. If the child is deprived of nurture, then it is a feeling that he or she will struggle to draw from later in life. At its root, nurture is the bodily experience of unconditional acceptance. This can be a great core strength in life, a feeling that can be brought to bodily consciousness and rested in as a resource. But this is not always achieved, and many people become conscious of a lack in themselves which they cannot explain, but can later be experienced as anxiety or lead to hesitant strategies in relationships, for example. If they cannot anchor the feeling of unconditional acceptance in themselves, then they may work too hard to find it from others and become overbalanced in their relationships. The second stage in the relationship to the body is described as mechanical. This is the mode of approach most often adopted by men, and one which can be very limiting and cold. School is the first place we learn a mechanical approach to the body. The principal meta-lessons of school are time and obedience. Once we cross the threshold into school for the first time, we're subjected to a series of rules which the body has to adjust to if it is to survive. This is the time when you use the toilet, when you play, when you study, when you leave, etc. The rules of time then extend beyond the classroom and are enshrined in homework and other time-based exercise. The longer school goes on, the longer the body calibrates itself according to the objective criteria of the education process. One body may struggle to reach this standard, and it will be pushed until it does so. Another body is relegated to the benches and no longer included. The mechanical approach to the body, of course, extends beyond lessons and infiltrates the consciousness of other children who are quick to measure themselves against one another. The mechanical approach to the body is enshrined in the gym and through other technical apparatus that encourage a continual monitoring of the body as a machine that has to be assessed. Need it be said that this mechanical approach helps foster a separation between mind and body, in which the former keeps an authoritarian perspective on what the latter is doing or can be permitted to do. If someone remains locked within this cold perspective, then he or she maintains an uneasy peace, in which happiness is the thin topping on the cauldron of emotions and sensations that are bubbling away. The problems I have discussed with men who remain deeply connected to this perspective are those which result from an overly mechanical approach on how the body should be operating. Erectile dysfunction is the most obvious example of an approach to the body which is exclusively mechanical. Men are confused by the malfunctions there and are angry with the body's failure to achieve an erection because it seems to be ignoring the rules that they, brain and body, have lived by thus far. This leads me to the third relationship to the body, which concerns intimacy. One can see that if the individual has been nurtured, then that deeply embodied sense of ease within the body can be comfortably re-expressed in intimacy with others. Intimacy becomes an extension of acceptance, permitting him to share that loving sense of abandonment in unity with others. However, for many reasons, intimacy is something that my clients have experienced problems with. If intimacy is a letting go, then that can represent a threat for those who have learned to become risk-averse as a way of staying safe. The apparatus of calculation that have developed out of a mechanical approach to the body is expressed through dating apps, pornography, and online encounters, to name but a few. These approaches to others offer potential at the same time they constrain. Caution is wise when it comes to protecting the body, but if it becomes the dominant attitude, then it can limit our encounters to the mere business of matching and not exploring. The intimacy that is calculated mocks us. The final prism through which we consider our relationship to the body concerns its ritual function. By ritual here I mean the bodily connection to others in serving tribal needs, food gathering, work, worship, travel, etc. For the most part, we live within tightly managed tribes, best exemplified in the family. The ritual functions here will include celebrations, as well as those duties that are required of each of us to keep our family working as an efficient unit. In the ritual function, there is a degree of sacrifice in which our own needs as individuals are temporarily suspended as less important than those of others. The body does what it needs to do and is not experienced as a difficulty, but as something that operates for others. It is perhaps only by operating in this way that we've been able to achieve progress as civilizations. However, when a body is entirely given over to ritual or the needs of others, then problems occur. For example, a parent that is completely dedicated to his children to the extent of starving himself so that they may eat is not looking after himself, and his sacrifices may come to harm him if he's too weak to support himself. A man who is so dedicated to a drinking, drug-taking, sexual tribe that he feels deprived when he is away from them is refusing to take ownership of his body in the name of the experience. The reasons for abandoning the body to the ritual function will be dealt with in the next talk when we consider the category of others. But from a bodily perspective, when we lose sight of the body in ritual function, we also abdicate responsibility for it. The body is not a free agent, but is always something that is part of us. A powerful drive in therapy is to understand how it is that clients have come to need experiences to lose themselves in. Is excessive abandonment to the ritual function of a crowd or scene driven by a need to escape the pressures of routine or reinvent themselves in the mind of others to free a body constrained by mechanical drives of everyday life? It is only by getting in touch with the body that we can begin to answer these questions and work on the relationship so that it can be cooperative and collaborative rather than driven by powerful, if unknown, forces. Others. I use the term others to refer to all the influences that have a role in the shaping of the child, from larger socioeconomic forces to the micro patterns of parenting. In the first instance, others represent the socio-political economic factors that establish the environment in which a child is raised. To be more specific, this entails considering the ways in which the parents mediate and transmit those factors in the way they conduct family life. For example, gender role. If a man is raised in an environment in which men go out to work, are defined as the breadwinner, and hang on to all the privileges that are traditionally associated with such roles, he may be shocked when he discovers that other men do not live this way. Class plays a significant role in the way people understand their world. What a family think of as natural may well be transmitted to the children as such, and this may make it more challenging for the latter when they try to impose such natural ways on their children when they set up their own families. On a more familial level, the existence of an extended supportive family also represent important defining others who can play a distinct influence on how a child develops. Issues of race and sexuality are crucial here too when a child considers how this aspect of his identity can be shared or revealed to others. It's not unusual in therapy for men to explain how aspects of their identity have remained hidden, for they fear the censure that would come with any revelation of difference. If a family is the central organizing machine for the perpetuation of heteronormativity, then it's crucial that the client be able to understand how his own background was shaped by certain material conditions. Equally significant is the role that this background plays in his unconscious. A child models what he sees in his immediate environment. What he sees around him is imprinted in and through his body. Boys and girls often grow up by learning from their parents, not in conscious ways, but by seeing and feeling what's going on at home. For example, if a child sits on the stairs every night, hearing his parents arguing or even fighting, this will, at the very least, produce a feeling and an impression of domestic life that will make it very problematic for him or her. If he becomes overly focused on this, then he may become someone for whom sacrifice is both a necessary and normal means of dealing with his partner, rather than re-experiencing the pain of loss and abandonment learnt on the stairs. If he is to survive beyond the paradigm of sacrifice, then the past has to be brought into bodily consciousness before it can be understood and transcended. Thus, an employee overly focused on getting everything right may find that he treats his boss with an uneven mixture of praise and blame. In this behavior, he may be doing all that is rationally required of him, but he is still struggling with the imprint of a childhood in which authority was powerful, but irrationally expressed and imperfectly understood. One of the most common complaints expressed by clients is that they are overwhelmed by the demands of others. A useful concept here is other-directed. An other-directed person spends a great deal of time and energy striving to impress others. These others may be there in the flesh or in the powerhouse of memory, or perhaps even brought together in their daily experience of themselves. But what is significant is the labor that goes into servicing what he or she thinks are the demands of others. This type of person can make an excellent employee, in so much as they never put the job down because their validation lies in completing their tasks well. They are often worriers because they pore over the detail of what has to be done, and of course these details can multiply the more they think about them. Anxiety often arises in the other directed because at the same time they are working hard to complete all the tasks they feel they have to do, a part of them knows that others can change their minds and move in directions they cannot predict. What we are looking for in the ideal is a relationship to others which is balanced. The individual should have the opportunity to belong to himself, as well as enjoying, through the ritual function, for example, his group or tribe. If he is pushed to make too much of a contribution to others, he may end up resenting them. However, given his need to maintain the crucial validating connection of others, he's unlikely to upset them deliberately. Thus, he sinks back into the body or overindulges in an attempt to escape from their need, whether real or imagined. Those clients I see who retreat into binging soon discover that their behavior is an attempt to escape the pressure that others represent. It can be a useful, even liberating moment for a client to hear that other clients are retreating into their body in exactly the same way. They come to understand that no one chooses to be other-directed. It's simply exhausting. If one is swamped by the needs of others, then he or she feels that they do not entirely belong to themselves. They can become trapped in a limited definition of themselves, which can make their days predictably exhausting. The therapeutic response to this is to consider the background factors that have helped shape their other-directedness, which often includes various dislocations. By dislocation, I mean both geographical shifts to different neighborhoods with alternative norms, different cultures, and new rules to learn, as well as dislocations in family life, divorce, separation, inexplicable deaths. The ways in which others deal with this becomes crucial in understanding how the child comes to understand and respond to others. What is unexplained to a child can sometimes feel as if it's their fault, and so we also have to investigate how their past was made sense of in the family and in their own consciousness. At the core of understanding the relationship to others is the fundamental concept of belonging. We are a tribal species who have, for the most part, lived in tribes. To be excluded from the tribe via tools such as shaming would have meant death. Tribes remain an important part of how we understand each other now. Instagram and Facebook, even professional societies, all retain the features of the tribe determined by the need to belong. The other directed individual has often had a troubling, insecure background, so he or she does all he can to retain his place in the tribe. But the cost of this is an unspoken, unexpressed resentment of the tribe for all that it takes out of him or her. In contrast, the introvert shuns all that the tribe represents. He might do so through a principled, well-constructed case, but his choice of exclusion is based on the anxiety that he could never fulfill the real or imagined needs of the group. Rather than facing exclusion, he chooses a solitary path, which offers him the security he needs for himself, but makes relationships problematic because past experiences have made him risk averse. This is not his fault. It is down to the others and the role they have come to play in his unacknowledged history. Thinking. It's usually the case that when I ask clients about their relationship to their thinking, they're confused. Men very closely identify with their thinking and believe it is who they are, even more so than their bodies and other public signs of themselves. The very idea of identifying, understanding, and then choosing a relationship to their thinking is difficult for most men to grasp at first. What I'd like to discuss here is how we can achieve this in order to arrive at a more equitable and helpful relationship to our thinking. A useful first step on this journey is the phrase, "Thinking is a terrible master, but an excellent servant." It may be worth thinking about this for a while. What difference would it make to your life to be able to treat your thoughts and your thinking not as a force you have to respond to, but as one you can choose to be with? Clients are often bullied by their thinking. That's an interesting proposal, isn't it? To be bullied by your thinking means to feel subordinate and harried by it. As we will discover in the final talk, emotions play a very large role in the way our thinking works. A full and honest contact with the emotions can get us to a place where we can change our relationship to our thinking. If you live in a relationship to your thinking in which it's constantly pushing you towards tasks, objectives, and deadlines, it can feel as if it's a manager not offering you any rest. If, for example, you are other-directed, your thinking is driven by the need to meet the anticipated needs of others. But as we have seen, this can be endless. I have watched clients driven by their thinking so that they rush to the end of my sentence and want a solution before they've grasped an understanding of what we were talking about or how the subject has even arisen. The mere act of suggesting that a relationship to thinking is not objective, but has been informed by one's background, may sometimes be enough to start bringing that relationship into full awareness. That gently liberating moment is one that we then begin to work upon. Cognitive behavioral therapy is focused on the task of considering how our thoughts work and changing our relationship to them by seeing how they work. A lot of value can be gained from considering thinking strategies such as personalization, magnification, arbitrary inference, and dichotomous thinking. Once clients begin to see that their thinking falls into these shapes and structures, it can make them feel less alone, are more empowered to monitor their thoughts, and take a more active role in how they occur and how to respond to them. This objectification of the thinking process has helped many people. However, from my perspective, CBT is a limited tool because it's not connected to the histories and functioning of our body, relationship to others, and our emotions. Our thinking is informed by all three of these factors and cannot really be fully understood in isolation from them. Many clients have come to see me after a program of CBT, still troubled by the force of their emotional lives and the fact that their histories are still finding expression through inexplicable moods and irrational reactions. I offer two modes of approach. The one focuses on the use of my model as a way of checking in with the client. Another is to begin meditation practice. Let's begin with an exercise I call the kite. Imagine yourself standing in a field or a beach holding onto the strings of a kite. It is a calm day, and you manage the kite easily. Now imagine a word imprinted on the kite. Let's imagine the word is COVID. Now see the word clearly and move through these four steps. Write each of these responses down and notice how quickly they come or not. Your body. On seeing the word COVID, what are your bodily reactions? Is the kite harder to control? Where do you feel the pressure? Is there a tightness in your chest or throat or stomach? Is the kite easily brought under your control, or are you wrenched or pushed around by it? Others. Does the word COVID inspire a concern for others? Which others? Family, friends, peer groups, colleagues? How does this feel? What might it tell you about your relationship to these others? Do you feel more for them than for yourself? Thinking. Are you overpowered by thoughts of what COVID means for you and your career when you see it on the kite? Do you research medical solutions and conspiracy theories? Is the virus making you overthink everything? Does it keep you awake? Emotions. Is COVID destabilizing your thinking by flooding you emotionally? Are you frightened, wary, suspicious, uncertain? To what extent does the word make you feel in balance, or has it thrown you and the uncertainties you live by? This exercise should take more than 2 minutes in total. It's important that you react and not overanalyze and patrol your responses. This exercise is meant to be a form of gentle checking in, but it will also reveal those aspects of the self which have been bypassed or are carrying too much of the load. For example, when I have done this exercise recently, men have stumbled to express too much concerning the body, and yet it can clearly be argued that COVID is very much about the body. The reasons why they have bypassed the body are, of course, many and varied, but it does suggest, at the very least, an ignorance of how the body is a resource that might be brought into play at this time, rather than being an afterthought. What I have found is that the response which comes most easily to men is in their thinking. Thinking is the vigilant sentinel always at the gate, offering an immediate and rational response. It can hardly be a surprise that men, focused on the left brain activities and shy of emotional forces, go so quickly to these ordered responses. But the purpose of this exercise is to show them that all parts of the self work together, and to exclude one of them inhibits the ability of all to work together. Meditation is a subject written about extensively elsewhere, and there are many guides and opportunities to develop a practice, but what I would like to stress is that the aim of practice is not to control your thoughts or to stop them, but to put you in touch with the body and the moment, so that you feel better able to deal with the torrent of thoughts pushing you around. In the austere form of meditation I was taught, all the individual does is sit in a comfortable position with eyes half closed and reacquaint yourself with your breathing. As you'll be breathing anyway, why not join in? Once you settle into the rhythm of the breath, you can use a phrase to watch your thoughts come and go. The end point of practice is to get to a point where you can see or be aware of your thoughts without engaging with them. Engagement might be thought of as turning the black and white images of thoughts flickering through consciousness into full color, and then adding sound, often operatic sound, and excited dialogues. After a few moments, your body begins to respond in the way it always has, and you are lost in habitual behavior and routine, and the meditative practice has gone. The choice now is whether to get up and re-engage in the world, or to pledge to return to practice. What the client can learn from these two exercises is that it's possible to get a distance on thoughts and thinking. The experience of respite from the rush of thoughts can be very liberating and offer the client an opportunity to change by our careful but diligently repeated sacrifice. When enough labor is enacted in this way, then the client could arrive at a space where thinking can indeed become a servant and not a master. Emotions. As one can perhaps imagine, emotions represent the subject that most men are very reluctant to broach. There are many reasons for this. A culture that celebrates machismo men who demonstrate a coldness with regard to their feelings, home life in which men do not discuss emotions, and working cultures where any expression of emotion could well segregate the speaker reckless enough to express himself. I remind you of the talk on others when we considered how the tribe patrols certain norms and these serve to maintain a status quo in which the expression of emotions is for weaker folk. Whilst not all men discuss their emotions, a large percentage of them take the neglect and forget strategy. This can work in the short term, but emotions do not go away because we've decided to suppress or neglect them. They remain very potent forces, not least because they go underground and pop up unexpectedly, for example, in getting irrationally upset at a commercial or expressing a remarkable limitless passion for your team. It may be that the commercial keys into some childhood experiences that have never been brought to consciousness and that this trigger is powerful and destabilizing. Passionate support for a group of millionaire athletes does not follow the same logical pattern of behavior that a man may bring to his working life, but membership of a club has echoes of belonging, sharing, and familiarity that he may struggle to find in his working life. In short, this too is a trigger that man can respond to emotionally because others are. Alas, men rarely look for an explanation to their responses and continue to function in the same inflexible ways. Men can come up against the force of their emotion in interesting ways. For example, many men are now invested in dieting and becoming as bodily conscious as women are. His approach typically offers a very rational direction. He will count calories, go to the gym, measure his portions, and adopt diets which have a proven scientific value. This ordered approach is a useful illustration of the mechanical body we discussed earlier. However, quite soon the dieter can encounter some difficulties that make no logical sense. For example, as much as he would like to cut out booze, he finds it difficult to change his drink in the pub in the name of a diet for fear it may make him sound feminine. The group's pull is greater than his own. Another man goes to the opposite extreme by taking a highly disciplined approach to his body because he views it through the eyes of others and has to shape himself in ways which connect to what he imagines they want. The emotional cost of ignoring his own feelings in this regard will eventually take their toll. The man who abdicates or at least relegates responsibility for his emotions may well find that they are being dealt with by the body not as a celebration of appetite, but as a means of managing what he cannot face. Overindulgence in food, drink, sex, and drugs is the legitimately celebrated means by which he can ignore his emotional life and remain connected to hegemonic masculinity. Excessive consumption is read as heroic abandon rather than whole-scale retreat. One of the most difficult but valuable skills clients can learn in therapy is the ability to be with their emotions. It is sometimes the case that I see men who have had difficulties with the law. They are coming to see me on the advice of lawyers or as a way of preparing for some time away. Many of these cases are excellent illustrations of men who have reacted from their emotions rather than being with them. For example, reacting to a provocation with violence rather than being able to walk away, indulging in other forms of excess rather considering the root of the emotion that is driving the behavior. The exercise that I use with men to get through these difficulties is a variant of an old Buddhist practice. You may know that Buddhism is focused on being with the emotions in a calm and peaceful fashion, so that the individual keeps away from the dangers and difficulties that arise when one simply reacts. This exercise is called RAIN. Briefly explained, RAIN works like this. When the individual is in the grip of a powerful emotion, the R stands for recognition. The recognition that he is experiencing a powerful emotion right now. In this moment of recognition, he is putting a pause before his perhaps habitual response. The A stands for acceptance. While it sounds obvious, this second stage is often difficult for men to achieve because they live within cultures which celebrate the dismissal of emotion through action. Once again, the pause is a moment of recognition before action is leapt into. The third step, I, stands for investigation. At this stage, the client is encouraged to take three related steps. To look into how his body is responding to the moment, where is the pain, difficulty or tension? Secondly, what are the other thoughts and do they represent some new directions to explore? Thirdly, what are the other feelings and emotions that are attendant upon this emotion? The final N of RAIN stands for non-attachment. This is the moment where the individual recognizes that these moments will pass and that what they have been suffering from is an attack on their idea of themselves, their ego. To attach to your ego is to attach to something that is fleeting. It is to destabilize yourself. The aim here is to take care of yourself as someone deserving compassion and not attach to the emotion, but to gently let it go. I need hardly add that this is a very difficult exercise and one that takes a lot of time to master. However, it's underscored by the need to be mindful of how we have been formed. If we can bring our various relationships to ourselves into consciousness sufficiently, then it can help us acknowledge and not simply follow our emotions into action. For many men, this is no small task because many factors prevent the investigation of feelings that have been traditionally associated with women. However, there are obviously substantial gains to be made by men understanding that emotions are a valuable part of our lives. Ideally, we get to the point in which men come to realize that their emotions are a valuable resource which can deepen the quality of their lives and make them more loving and receptive partners, parents, and friends.